This show is brought to you by Gobble by Kevin Carr, a Thanksgiving novelette of the zombie apocalypse, and you thought your family dinner was stressful. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On the last show of 2016, I'm going to be talking about 20th Century Women, Patterson, Lion, and the best and worst of the year in terms of movies, just the top three on either side. I don't have a five-hour show. I can't talk about the entire list of 10. I'm also going to be talking about a little bit of news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news, I want to give a little bit of a thank you to our good friend Chris from Florida. He sent me a Christmas message. I didn't download it because I'm a lazy SOB, so my apologies. But yes, Chris, he's written into the show before. Thank you for taking the time to write to us. And then I had a Merry Christmas, waiting for a good and safe and healthy and happy new year. Another piece of news, and I'm just going to breeze by this, was the Golden Globe nominations, because they seem sort of anticlimactic to me. And maybe that's because the Critics' Choice Movie Awards was so early, and I vote in that. And that kind of set the stage. I mean, yeah, you've got like National Board Review out there. But usually the Golden Globes sets that stage for the Oscars, but I just didn't see anything all that surprising coming out of the Golden Globe Awards. I mean, yeah, you see there and see Deadpool get nominated, but that's for Best Comedy. And they actually had a widespread of comedy and musical numbers. And you had like Florence Foster Jenkins, and which is both kind of, and you had La La Land, and then you had comedies like Deadpool, and they had 20th Century Women, which arguably may not be a comedy, but there's always those that fall in there. The only thing that really stuck out to me was seeing that Hell or High Water got some praise. It got a whole bunch of nominations, which is great because it's a great little movie that I thought was kind of done, had sort of fallen back in the background. So this might revitalize it a little bit. And then I'm also a little bit surprised at the love that's out there for Lion. I'll be talking about that later in the show. But it got a little bit of Critics' Choice love, but it's not something that's really flying high on the radar of pretty much anything except for award junkies, I guess. But that's about it on the Golden Globes. I might delve into them a little bit later. I'm certainly going to talk about them more when the ceremony approaches. But I just want to take a few minutes to talk about Carrie Fisher. As everyone already knows, Carrie Fisher passed away this week. And it was a bit of an ordeal because she was on a plane and had a heart attack. And as I understand it, she was taken to the hospital, never regained consciousness, and whether she was taken off life support. The whole issue happened over several days. And it's very sad. She was only 60. Even that's pretty young to die. I mean, 60 is still pretty young. I mean, that's not a shockingly young death. I mean, that's not like when Anton Yelchin died earlier this year. But still, 60, there's a lot to do beyond 60. And this is not me getting on any problem with Carrie Fisher on her case. I mean, she was very open about this. She had a lot of problems with drugs and alcohol back in the 80s. And, you know, propelling to stardom, when you're 19, going into stardom, when you have Eddie Fisher's genes, and becoming that rich and famous that young, at that era, you're going to be taking a lot of drugs. And I'm sure that had a lasting impact on her health. You can do damage to the heart. With that much cocaine, you can really do damage to the heart. And you may not see that happen until you're 60 years old, and you're off the problem stuff, and you're sober and everything. But that kind of damage is one of those silent killers that you don't see. And that's a shame. But when it comes to Carrie Fisher's death and her legacy, I was asked on the radio several times to come on and talk a little bit about her. And you can't talk about Carrie Fisher without talking about Star Wars. And that's not to say that was her only thing, because like most of the actors, she tried to distance herself from Star Wars in the 80s, because most of the time when you have something that's kind of popular, it comes out of nowhere, people do try to distance themselves. Leonard Nimoy tried to distance himself from Star Trek back in the 70s. And eventually he embraced it as he got older. And Carrie Fisher re-embraced this once they started making new Star Wars movies. Obviously, she was in The Force Awakens. She's in the next one. And that one, as I understand it, they've wrapped her filming. So that's not going to actually cause a problem with the film. We'll see what happens when they do episode 9. She tried to distance herself, and she did a lot of it cutting her hair very, very short because, of course, she had the long hair in the Star Wars movies, very well known for that. And even in movies like The Blues Brothers, she had very long hair. She then came into her own as a writer and it was able to show off a really wicked sense of humor, which came out in her semi-autographical book, Postcards from the Edge. And, of course, she did other books. And became a very popular script doctor. She actually had a career like Mark Hamill, who kind of ran away from Luke Skywalker and then found a real niche in voiceover work. Carrie Fisher found a real niche in writing, and that's wonderful. I mean, she did other things. She spoke out about mental illness, and she did bring a lot of attention to a lot of causes. And even, you know, recently she didn't want to talk about Star Wars until she kind of came back into the family. And I think that was wonderful that at the very least, Carrie Fisher got a chance to come back into the Star Wars family, be embraced by Star Wars and embrace it herself, because it's what made her famous, for better or for worse. And she could share that again with a new generation. And it's sad to see her go, and it's sad to see anyone go that early. And then even sadder was when Debbie Reynolds, just the day later, passed away. But that's one of those things that you see that happen when people are very close. And, you know, I mean, Debbie Reynolds was not terribly healthy, and she was 84, which is much, much older than 60. The emotional weight of that is going to have an impact. And I don't know if there was any sort of connection or if it's just she had her chance to go and make peace. So it's sad. Both Carrie Fisher, Debbie Reynolds, right at the end of the year. Very, very sad to see them go. Rest in peace. And we will be thinking of them always. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Let's talk about these movies in chronological order. The first one is Alien Covenant. I've been waiting for this trailer. Alien Covenant, directed by Ridley Scott, after Prometheus, opens on May 19th.
Paris, please, open up!
I can't do that without an infection.
You sure about this, Captain?
How do you mean?
I really don't know what's out there.
I unabashedly love the Alien movies. Now, I mean, some of them, like Alien Resurrection, is really stupid, and Alien 3 is a colossal failure. Interesting to watch at times, but it's a colossal failure. Probably one of David Fincher's worst movies he's ever made. But I loved seeing Ridley Scott come back and do stuff with Prometheus. And one of the reasons why I like Prometheus is because it went beyond just a monster killing people. It really opened up the world. And as much as people complained about saying, oh, it just showed you too much about the space jockey and it wasn't the xenomorphs and we didn't get any answers and we got more questions and it tried to explain it too much. I loved that. I love the fact that the alien bit that we get in the other movies is just a teeny tiny little sliver of what's out there. Now, in this one, of course, it looks like they are going to have xenomorphs in it, or at least something similar to it, chest bursters and face huggers and all that good stuff. I'm very much looking forward to this movie. The next one is The Emoji Movie. Opens on August 4th.
Hello. As you can see, I'm an emoji. A meh, to be exact. Anywho, it's my pleasure to announce our first movie. Yay. So bring the family. Doesn't have to be your family.
I didn't even know that this movie was going to happen. I didn't even know it existed. And it's kind of terrifying because this takes Angry Birds to a different level. I mean, Angry Birds at least has somewhat of a story and plot behind it, but this is about emojis. Talk about a stretch. This could either be hilarious and awesome, like the Lego movie, or it could be a colossal failure and be really, really stupid. I have a feeling it's going to lean more towards stupid, partly because it's an August release date. Unless they're going to find a way to sausage party it. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about 20th Century Women and Lion. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr in our New Year's segment, getting ready to wrap up 2016 and ring in the new year. But before we do that, let's talk about a couple little stragglers from 2016. One of the movies we're going to be talking about is 20th Century Women. In the late 1970s, a single mother struggles to raise her son and give him a positive male role model.
I think maybe you guys can help me with Jamie. How do you be a good man? What does that even mean nowadays?
Don't you need a man to raise a man? Well, it
seems so real. You just feel guilty because it's just me and you.
You don't know what I'm feeling. Men always feel like they have to fix things for women or they're not doing anything. Just be there. Somehow that's hard for all of you.
Well, I'm not all men. Okay, I'm just me.
It's so odd for me to talk about this movie because I saw it quite a while ago. Part of it is because they wanted to get it out there for award consideration for me and the other critics locally, where in Columbus, Ohio, where I'm from. So I saw this well before Thanksgiving, and I've just been sort of sitting on it because it's not out. I'm not one of those people who likes to review movies that nobody's able to see. My philosophy is if you listen to this show, you should be able to get in your car and then go see a movie that I'm talking about or rent it online or something like that. I think it's just silly and somewhat braggadocious and arrogant to review movies that nobody can actually go check out right away. Now, 20th Century Women is out, so I can give you my thoughts on it. So I'm sort of pulling them back from what I saw almost 2 months ago. This is directed by the guy who did Beginners, which I thought was a good movie. A very different type of film that this is, and it obviously focuses on the women and the structure. Oddly enough, the main character's a guy. I mean, the main character's really Annette Bening. She plays the mother, and she's the mother of this kid. It's sort of like a coming-of-age movie. It's his coming-of-age movie told from the women in his life. Of course, his mother, who's overbearing, and, you know, she would do great with Viggo Mortensen's Mr. Fantastic character. They could run off together. She's very cynical. She's very, at times, very dark. And then you've got him having a good relationship with Greta Gerwig, who also lives with them as a boarder. And then Elle Fanning, who is a girl he likes. And she's provocative and she's sexually active, but he's just friend-zoned by her. And that's where I thought it sort of lost an opportunity, because it wasn't either his reaction of being friend-zoned or her reasoning for being friend-zoned. It just sort of happened, and there was some interesting things there that I thought could be examined, but it was just thrown out there like a dead fish, just like, there's the friend zone. That's a storyline. We're not going to talk about that. And therein lies part of the problem with this film, is it doesn't know what it's trying to accomplish. It doesn't know whose story it's trying to tell. And some people may praise it for that, because it juggles these storylines, but it just felt sort of haphazard, because while you get this ensemble cast, you really find it hard to root for any one person, because it sort of shifts narratives here and there. It's really not my cup of tea anyways, I'll just have to say. It's sort of this character study of like I said, it's a coming-of-age movie of this kid. And I've come of age. I didn't come of age in 1979, but pretty close. I was about his age. You know, we're not that far away in terms of, I was about that age in like the mid 80s. So 6 years later, I was dealing with what this kid was dealing with. So I should have been able to relate to the kid. I just really couldn't. And part of it's because the grown-ups in his lives were such hot messes and such absolute disasters that I couldn't get into it. Plus, I'm not a big Annette Bening fan. She kind of had this 1-2 punch of this and Rules Don't Apply. And while she's getting a lot more note for this, I still wasn't a big fan of it. So I'm going to have to say, even with Greta Gerwig, who I think is adorable, she her character was kind of sidelined as well. So I'm going to have to say that 20th Century Women kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Lion. Dev Patel plays an Indian man adopted by Australians who is determined to reconnect with his family that he had been lost from when he was a child.
Let's start with where you're from.
Calcutta.
Which part?
I'm starting to remember.
Saroj, our beautiful boy.
A life I'd forgotten.
Are you okay?
I had another family.
What happened?
I was lost. I have to find my way back home.
First of all, I think it's great to see Dev Patel actually play a character who's not from India with a Indian accent. I mean, he's British. I mean, he's of Indian descent. I mean, I'm Irish, but technically I'm Irish, I'm Hungarian, but I'm an American. I grew up in America. Dev Patel's British. So when you see him in movies like The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel or Slumdog Millionaire, and he's talking like this because he's got this little Indian accent and he sounds like a caricature. That's not his accent. Now, this one, he's an Australian, so at least he's playing with the accent. But it's nice to see Dev Patel actually get an acting role where he, or at least a high-profile acting role where he's not trying to play a stereotypical Indian. Still, I'm not a huge fan of Dev Patel. I think he does fine in this movie. It's part of the thing is the trailers. If you watch the trailers, it starts with him as an adult. But there's this whole first half of the movie about how he gets lost. And it's based on a true story, essentially, that he and his brother, they take a train somewhere, and he doesn't get off the train. And since he's poor, and he doesn't go to school, and he's, you know, he lives in the slums of Calcutta, he has no way of knowing where he ended up. And so it's him trying to navigate and find a way out. He ends up getting adopted up to this Australian couple. I think the first half of the movie is far more interesting than the second half because it really shows the plight of some of these children. So it shows a real life in Calcutta of poverty. I mean, severe poverty. And it reminds me a little bit of Queen of Katwe, mainly because while it shows that extreme poverty in a certain area, and in Queen of Katwe, it was in Africa. They had this extreme poverty, but it wasn't devastating to live there. That's just there was their lives. It's just treated as that's what they do. That's how they live. That's just the life of somebody living in the slums of Calcutta. But it does show the dangers that he doesn't face at home. It shows him the dangers of when he's then alone on his own. And there are some very near misses. And like I said, apparently it's based on a real story about this kid. And then when he becomes an adult after being adopted by an Australian family, it's him looking back and saying, hey, I want to reconnect. And that's where it sort of turns into this weird sort of white people on a white horse kind of coming in to save the day, which tends to happen a lot in movies, especially from Hollywood, where it's like, oh, we need the rich Europeans or the rich Australians or the rich Americans to save the day. And there is this portion in the middle where his character, it's almost like Bella in a Twilight movie of him just moping about the fact that I'm never going to find my family. I'm never going to find out where I came from. And that sort of nonsense just bores me in a movie. And I get why they do it because they're trying to show the emotional journey. But it's very cliche and it's overdone. When he finally makes that ultimate ending journey, it's interesting and it's powerful emotionally. The story's fascinating. It's just there's a lot of crap thrown in there that they probably could have edited out, especially when he was an adult. But overall, it's an interesting movie. It's not best of the year. I don't know why everyone's going nuts over this movie. It's not best of the year. I don't hear anyone else aside from award nominations talking about it. But still, I'm going to have to say Lion kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Patterson and the best films of 2016. Because we can. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews of new movies this week. And they're scant and few, and you may not be able to find them right away. But these are technically opening this week. One of them is Patterson. It's directed by Jim Jarmusch. A bus driver in New Jersey has a secret talent for poetry that his artistic wife tries to foster.
Ready to roll, Patterson?
Yeah.
When you're a child, you learn there are three dimensions: height, width, and depth, like a shoebox. Then later you hear there's a fourth dimension, time.
Your poetry is really good, and someday you might let the world read it. Look me in the eye. You are a great poet.
I have a confession to make. I watched Patterson about a week ago. I got a screener for it. It's award season. That happens. I cannot for the life of me tell you how it ended. I think it was just a slice of life movie, which tends to be very Jim Jarmusch-y. And I know there are people out there that are wild and crazy and diehard rabid Jim Jarmusch fans. And there are some of his films I've seen that I've liked. I thought Ghost Dog: Way of the Samurai was very interesting. Dead Man with Johnny Depp was extremely interesting. Stranger Than Paradise, one of his earlier movies, not very good, even though it's what put him on the map in a lot of ways. I remember watching Gimme Danger earlier this year, which is a documentary he did about Iggy Pop and the Stooges. It didn't feel like there was anything special about it. And then I'm like, oh, it's a Jim Jarmusch movie. Oh, okay. Well, it felt like every other rockumentary retrospective I've ever seen. So you got to realize I'm not coming at this from a diehard Jim Jarmusch fan. Now, Adam Driver plays the bus driver. Ironically, he's Adam Driver playing a bus driver named Patterson who lives in Patterson, New Jersey. So there's this weird little reality meets the movie name thing going on, which I thought was kind of funny. And he's interesting in it. It's a very subdued performance, and it's very internalized, and it's basically about this, as I take it, it's about this gem of artistic ability in the most unlikely of places, just a bus driver in Patterson, New Jersey. And he hears things from people, just bits of conversation and interactions he has with others, either at a bar that he goes to or, you know, just people on the bus or people he sees when he's walking his dog. And his wife is a Liberty Gibbet kind of artist. I mean, she's there painting his shower curtain and stuff like that. The question is she very much an artist? Because she seems very one-dimensional with the art that she does. And he's the one who's the real artist in his writing, and she wants him to foster that, but he's kind of too scared, which happens a lot with writers. And that's not to say every writer is an artist, because some of them are, quite frankly, terrible. But there's a lot of writers who don't want to show their work to anybody. And sometimes that's a good thing, that your work's not very good. But sometimes it's a shame, because, you know, great talent could be lost or never even discovered. But that's really what it is. It's a slice of life kind of movie. That's what I got out of it. I mean, like I said, it had that little of an impact on me. And again, very much like 20th Century Women, there are some people that just think it's a great movie, should be, and it's on top 10 lists and everything. It's extremely disposable and, you know, in and out for me. I was like, oh, okay, that was it. And I had to watch this movie. Let me put it on. And then it was over. And I'm sitting here behind a microphone realizing I don't remember a whole lot about it. For that reason, I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks, mainly because I now realize what little impact it had on me. Maybe it'll be different for you. Who knows?
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now that I've completely trounced all over a couple well-known award films that some people are putting on their best of the year list, let's talk about my best of the year list. I'm going to just do three. I'll give a couple honorable mentions afterwards, but I'm going to give you my top three. In the number three spot is a movie from a director who had gotten a bad reputation, but he's a fantastic director, and he's won an Academy Award. When I saw this film, I said, hey, this is about time to forgive him as a director, because he's very good at what he does. And the director I'm talking about is, of course, Mel Gibson, and the movie is Hacksaw Ridge.
always dreamed about being a doctor, but didn't get much school. I can't stay here while all them go fight for me.
But you figure this war is just going to fit in with your ideas?
While everybody else is taking life, I'm going to be saving it. And that's going to be my way to serve.
As you heard, it's a story of a conscientious objector going to World War II, and instead of carrying a gun, he carries a medic pouch. Goes into battle in the Battle of Okinawa with no gun and becomes an American hero. And you know, the first half of the movie can be very corny, a little bit goofy at times. I'm not quite sold on Andrew Garfield's accent. But I'll tell you, man, from basic training, I mean, they have the stuff with basic training, and some of his home life stuff is a little bit dull or cliche, and it gets a little bit heavy-handed at times. But boy, where it really gets you is that the ending battle, the combat that you see. And I've not been in combat, but this is harrowing, and it makes you not want to go into combat. I mean, this is intense stuff. Great film. In a lot of ways, hard to watch. Not just because of the violence, but just the context of the violence and the reality of that violence. Hacksaw Ridge is the kind of movie that you want to see and honor the vets that have served and are serving our country right now. So yeah, Hacksaw Ridge, one of the best movies of 2016. The next one is also by a famous director who sometimes gets a little bit of side eyes from people. And that movie is, of course, Sully, starring Tom Hanks as the pilot who landed the Miracle on the Hudson.
Our job is to investigate how a plane ended up in the Hudson River.
On the Hudson.
It's not a crash. It was a forced water landing.
Simulation showed that you could make it back to the airport.
Not possible. I felt it go.
Now, Clint Eastwood directed this, and I blow hot and cold with his movies. I thought Letters from Iwo Jima was great. I thought that Flags of Our Fathers was terrible. Recently, I mean, I loved American Sniper. I thought American Sniper was a brilliantly done film that not everybody got, but I loved American Sniper and I loved Sully. And one of the reasons I love Sully so much, and I know a lot of people say, well, you know, the incident itself was like 10 minutes as the plane takes off and lands and that's it. The reason I love this movie was because it's told from a unique perspective. It's told, you got to realize, they don't hammer this home, but you kind of have to realize this as you're watching it. It's completely from his perspective. And so, yes, it's heavy-handed. Yes, it seems like he's being overly persecuted. Yes, it's very sensitive to him, but that's because it's from his point of view. It's based on his account of the book that he co-authored. And it shows the second-guessing that goes on, the post-traumatic stress that goes on, the dealing with being called a hero when you don't necessarily feel like you are, especially when you're not being treated like one. And not to mention the fantastic performance that's done by Tom Hanks. It's a great movie. So Sully, number two movie of 2016. And finally, the number one movie of 2016. If you know me, you know I love animation. I've always loved animation. If you look at my top 10 list from many years in the past, there's always at least a couple sometimes, maybe two or three animated films in the list. And it is not uncommon for me to herald these. And there's a lot of people who kind of look at, oh, well, those are just cartoons. They're not. There's an artistry and a brilliance to doing good animation. And it's been a competitive year for animation with Finding Dory and Zootopia and Moana and The Secret Life of Pets. I mean, there's been a lot of movies. Even there have been crappy ones like Storks and Trolls I didn't particularly like. And the one that comes out on top and tops all the other movies for me is Kubo and the Two Strings.
My name is Kubo. This is my story.
Your enemies aren't far behind.
Your magic is the only thing that can protect us. You need to learn control.
Release! Yeah. No!
Do you ever say anything encouraging?
I encourage you not to die.
Now, the reason I love this movie so much is because there's an artistry to it. There's a detail to it. And they've done movies with stop motion stuff like Coraline and Box Trolls and Paranorman. And the detail has gotten much, much better. And Leica does such a great job with this. It's almost a lost art that they're keeping alive, along with the people at Aardman Animation. But beyond just the look of the movie, it's just a great story. It's a mature story, but it's also something kids can relate to. So Kubo and the Two Strings, my favorite movie of 2016. Couple honorable mentions, Swiss Army Man and The Witch. Those you're not going to see on a whole lot of lists. I like both of those. Those are kind of weird genre little picks that I loved. Listen back to old archives of me talking about them. And of course, Sing Street, which is an old one from earlier this year that not a whole lot of people remember, but it's such a charming coming of age movie. And this is from the guy who did Once, and I didn't like Once, but boy, I love the heck out of Sing Street. Anyways, that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the worst of 2016, the box office, and the home cinema round.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now that we've done the best of 2016, let's move on to the worst of 2016. And what's funny, when it comes to worst movies, I always get a little bit of glee from doing these lists. And I know there's some people, there are critics out there, they're like, oh, you know, piling on and talking about bad movies is you know, that I'm above that. I'm not above it. I'm sorry. I'm not. Because you know what? This is my job. And I look at movies out there, and there's a lot of mediocre movies out there. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot that fall in the middle. There's a lot that are pretty good or pretty bad that don't hit that best and worst. At the end of the year, though, when I make these two lists, I always do that short list. And I always tend to have more in that initial list of worst movies than I do best movies. And a lot of that's because to make a fantastic movie, that takes a lot of effort, and that's lightning in a bottle. To make a terrible movie, there's a lot of mediocre movies that fail and become terrible movies. And that's why I tend to see more. And then also part of it's because I have to suffer through these movies. All these movies I put on the list, I have seen. Some of them I've spent real money to go see. And it's a great way to just sort of vent my spleen and cathartic relaxation of getting this off my chest to let you know these movies are terrible and to really twist the knife. And there's nothing wrong with that because it's fair game. Now, you will see a theme, especially in number 3 and 2, of movies that I don't like, but are actually very competently made movies. They're movies that maybe they're shot beautifully. Maybe they got a great cast. And from a technical side, they're brilliantly done. But there's something about the movies I don't like, and that's what kills it for me. And in this, it's oftentimes the messaging, what the movie's saying, either intentional or unintentional, or if it's just sometimes the characters. Now, I don't mind gray characters, and I don't mind characters that are not the nicest people. I mean, there's fantastic movies that are populated with not very nice people, but they're very interesting and intriguing and fun. You know, the Godfather movies are all about criminals, but they're incredibly compelling characters. Or like Boogie Nights is about people in the porn industry. And I love that movie, even though they're all, this is a land of misfit toys, but there's something lovable about them and some sort of family nature to the characters in Boogie Nights. The ones that are on these lists, these are movies that have characters that I find repulsive or reprehensible or doing things that nobody calls them out on doing the wrong thing. And the first one that hits that is number 3 on the list, which is Collateral Beauty.
This might be the strangest thing I have ever come across. He writes letters.
Who are they to?
Howard doesn't write letters to people. He writes to things.
Time.
Love. Death.
This is Will Smith trying to win an Oscar again and not happening. And what's great, this movie's still out in the theaters for you guys to go out to and not see. It's this very well-done movie with a fantastic cast. And it has actually kind of an interesting yet cheesy setup where he gets visited by concepts that he writes letters to. Spoiler alert, there are actors that are hired by his friends in order to gaslight him so he can sell his company. It is the most mean-spirited, underhanded, deceitful approach to a movie, and then they try and kind of spin it around and say, oh, well, no, it's really sweet. No, it's not. These are horrible people doing a horrible thing, and that's why I hated this movie. And it fails on all fronts. And I mean, poor Will Smith acts his guts out in this movie, but he's surrounded by crap in terms of the story and the characters. Now, number 2 on the list, It's another one that I feel that way about. Beautifully shot movie. Great little cast, actually. It's Me Before You. Stars Emilia Clarke as a woman who falls in love with a quadriplegic.
When I was a kid, this used to be my favorite place in the whole world.
So where's better than this, then?
Paris.
Well, so let's go. We could get on the Eurostar right now.
You don't get it, Clark. I want to be in Paris as me. The old me.
And if you remember me talking about this one back when it came out, he was not a nice person to begin with. He's super wealthy, and he's basically a corporate raider in England. But he's quadriplegic because he stupidly walked out in front of a motorcycle. And the big thing is that he wants to kill himself. And the die with dignity thing, I respect that. You know, if you've got some terminal disease that's going to force you to live in your own feces and vomit and just completely disintegrate in front of your loved ones, I can understand you taking that route and saying, let's take care of this early. But the crux of the movie, which appears in that little clip I played, he's basically like, well, I can't do what I used to do. I can't ski in Belize. I can't walk down the street in Paris. I can't have sex the way I used to. He has no want of comfort. And true, in the book, apparently, that he was very much in pain constantly. But you don't see that in the movie. So I'm judging it by the movie. And the movie's basically, he's just like, I can't surf anymore. I can't get on a jet ski. I should kill myself. And what does that say to the people, the disabled people on this earth who are not rich and powerful and don't have all the money to get out? There's a lot of good that can come from you. Take a page out of Christopher Reeve's book, who becomes a quadriplegic and then makes something very positive of his life. Eventually, he dies a premature death, but he made something of his tragedy. He didn't just wallow in his own self-pity and then decide to kill himself. There's so much more to life than just being able to walk. And ask anyone in a wheelchair and they'll tell you that. And that's why this movie hits that number two on the list. Now, the number one worst movie of 2016, you may not remember, because it came out back in January, which is not an uncommon time for bad movies to come out. And this one is 50 Shades of Black.
So, how did you make your money?
I exercise control in all things, Miss Steele.
And you don't want somebody like me.
I don't do romance.
I need to know why you won't have a real relationship with me.
Let's just say my life wasn't always easy.
If you recall, this is a movie by Marlon Wayans spoofing 50 Shades of Grey. And every word from that sentence should tell you it's a terrible movie. It's so bad that the other members of the Wayans family didn't put their names on it. He's kind of alone hanging out in the wind on this movie. But part of the other thing is 50 Shades of Grey is a one-note joke. You can't stretch it. It's like maybe you can make fun of it in a Saturday Night Live sketch, but they're trying to stretch it into an entire film. This movie's so bad and uncomfortably bad. And I know people who have actually liked it. I have a friend who thought it was a great movie. I don't know what he was smoking at the time, but man, this movie's terrible. And this one's very different than the other two that I mentioned. I mean, this one is just genuinely trying to be stupid and funny, and it just fails miserably. The only thing that makes it a little better than like a Haunted House and a Haunted House 2 is it wasn't found footage. And what's interesting, speaking of found footage and the dishonorable mentions, there's none in there that I really have that's a found footage movie. There's one in my top 10 list, and you can check that out on the Fat Guys at the Movie site later this week. But the other ones that are sort of getting the dishonorable mentions are Triple Nine, which was this terrible, again, characters I didn't like in a cop drama. 31, which is directed by Rob Zombie, about another torture porn family group trying to kill people. And once again, none of the characters are likable. The victims aren't likable. I really didn't care what happened to them. It wasn't so, you weren't even feeling bad for bad things happening to these people. And then finally, God's Not Dead 2, which is the most insanely twisted, made up version of Persecution. It's such a bad sequel to a bad movie that strawmans its arguments and doesn't actually exist in any sort of reality. And that is it for the Fat Guys of the Movies, worst of the year 2016. Next, let's talk about the box office. Was I correct? Last week I said that Rogue One was going to lead and Sing was going to come in a very close second. And I was right. I was right with that 1-2 placement. Now, there's different ways to look at it. I mean, you can look at it as the 3-day weekend, which was December 23rd, 24th, and 25th. Rogue One made $64 million. Sing made $35 million. But if you look at it as a 4-day weekend, because Of course, the 26th was the day after Christmas, and most people got that off since it was an observed holiday because Christmas fell on a Sunday. Rogue One made $96 million over that four-day weekend. It made almost $100 million on its second four-day weekend. Now, that's not as good as Force Awakens, but boy, that's still really good. Again, that beats any opening in December aside from The Force Awakens, and that's for its second weekend in a row. Sing, of course, made $55 million that weekend. Passengers did, I guess, okay with 22.5. I think that's underperforming, but I think they knew it was going to do poorly. This week, I think that Rogue One's going to win again. There's nothing new, big coming out. And I think a good $60 million for the weekend. And if you talk, even if you talk like a four-day, maybe a little bit higher than that. And Sing's going to hold up well. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Real quickly, I'm just going to run these through, and because there's nothing big that comes out really after Christmas, but if you're running around with gift cards and you want to buy them, these are ones that are out there in the stores. You got Snowden, which, of course, Oliver Stone's film about Edward Snowden. American Honey, In a Valley of Violence, which is Ty West's very violent Western, but a very good movie. And then The Dressmaker, starring Kate Winslet, which I actually haven't seen yet. Anyways, that is it for this week. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Underworld Blood Wars, which is the only new one, but there'll also be expansions of Hidden Figures and A Monster Calls. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.